Now we have a short story by E.M. Forster in which two childhood friends go on to lead very different lives. Peter Kenny reads, Ansel.
"It's a cruel box," said the porter, who, beguiled by its moderate size, had hoisted it onto his shoulder and then hastily dumped it back on the platform. "The weight's cruel. That'll need a barrow."
"Yes," I replied. "It's books."
"Books? I don't know with books in the country. What you want is recreation and hair and exercise."
He cast a searching glance at my stooping shoulders and bounced away with a barrow, calling out,
"Just hurry and open the back of the cart. You got a library this journey, I can tell you."
A large boned person got up from the front seat, and as he turned, I saw that it was Ansel. I hesitated a moment as to what would be the proper thing to do, and then held out my hand, which he grasped in a vice and swung from side to side like a scythe. That long handshake is a wonderful thing. It may merely mean shyness, but it can also denote reproach, forgiveness, or intense affection. In this case, I took it as punishment for snobbishness, for it left my fingers squeezed together like macaroni, and my hand the colour of old parchment. Ansel had not lost his simple manner, and apologised with total freedom from self-consciousness for being himself in a tweed suit and the muck cart with Josiah, instead of Charles in livery with a landau. He then took up the book box and heaved it with precision into the back. The cart immediately tilted at a miserable angle, and the shafts plucked Josiah heavily and rose into the air. My visits to the hall had not been frequent, but they had been lengthy, and had allowed me to make Ansel's acquaintance. The first had been when I was 14, and he was garden and stable boy. We were thrown at one another by my cousin, who thought it nice I should have a companion, and in a few days we were on the most intimate footing. We scraped out a hole in the side of the large straw stack and made it into a house where we stored apples and gooseberries and cola lemonade, which we got cheap from Ansel's aunt in the village. We made birdlime from a recipe in the Boy's Own book and caught Mrs. Perrell's prize bantam chickens in it. The sound of our whoops and shrieks as we jumped with abandon on one another's hats penetrated even into the smoking room, where my father was arguing with my cousin as the respective merits of Eton and Winchester as a school for me. The noise exasperated them. My cousin was aghast at the friendship he had created, and my father did not like my entire separation from rational companions and pursuits. I had suddenly stopped reading and no longer cared to discuss with him the fortunes of the Punic War or the course of Aeneas from Troy. The result was an intervention of the powers. I and Ansel were only to play together once a week, and then it was to be something sensible, cricket, or bat, trap and ball. And then I went away to school. I came again when I was 18. Ansel was now sole gardener and only occasional stable boy. I had just got a scholarship at Cambridge and was resting after my labours, but I had forgotten how to rest and preferred reading to outdoor amusements. Ansel, once or twice, suggested taking me shooting or teaching me to swim, but I refused, partly because I now found him such a dull companion, partly because I did not shine at outdoor pursuits. I was very sensitive on this point and knew that Ansel would laugh at my incompetencies, and this I could not bear. Now I met him again. The deficiencies of 18 were accentuated at 23, but I had also gained the armour of the grown-up person, which can ward off the lesser shafts of disapproval and ridicule. We were now so very different that comparison was painless and even interesting. I was writing a dissertation on the Greek optative for a fellowship, and Ansel was now gamekeeper to the small shooting my cousin had recently purchased and only occasional gardener and groom. I began to put him at his ease.
"How you've grown, Ansel."
"Aye, Master Ed."
"Sir,
and how you've grown."
"Josiah doesn't alter."
"Do you remember the times we used to have? The bird lime?"
"And the plum tree with a branch you broke."
We were feeding on the past, and I knew that we could not live by that alone. So I went on to inquire after our common acquaintance, he replying in a chant.
"Oh, he's very well. Oh, she's very well. Oh, he went come this 2 year."
Dead silence ensued, which was well enough for Ansel, to whom it merely meant that neither of us had any more to say. But to educated people, silence matters. It is a token of stupidity and lack of invention. I racked my brains for some remark that would serve to keep my self-respect, but could find none. Ansel remained motionless, staring in front of him at Josiah's ears. He too was thinking, as the sequel proved, but felt under no obligation to speak till the thought was ripe. Whereas, unless I speak, I cannot go on thinking. At last it came. He tossed his head at the back of the cart and said, "Them books." Ansel's remark was not meant as a criticism, but merely signified the topic which he would like to hear me discuss. I did not shrink. I knew he would not sympathize, but I did not mind that now. After 6 years of a student's life, I was perfectly inured to attacks upon my implements. I had heard books attacked for their bulk, their weight, their fragility, their similarity, their contradictiousness, their uselessness, their effect upon the figure, their drain upon the pocket, and also for their contents. My dissertation was to be sent in within a month. I had only just begun to write it out, but had my notes all prepared, editions interleaved and annotated, and pages of cross-references and criticisms of rival theories. The optative does not admit of very flowing treatment, and I had plenty of time to dump my remarks down and get them typewritten. My cousin had invited me to stay with him, and I had refused on the score of work, but on his renewing the invitation and offering the library, for which he had just bought an Encyclopaedia Britannica for my exclusive use, I accepted, though I had to bring my own books, since neither the encyclopedia nor the 100 best books which balanced it would quite suit my purpose. There they all were, in the box behind, the seeds and the fruit of my career. In response to Ansel's remark, I rapidly sketched my past, leaving out its numerous triumphs with becoming, though superfluous, modesty. I then explained the reason for the particular books, how I was engaged in writing about the grammar that was spoken by the Greeks in ancient times, and how, if what I had written was considered better than what had been written about Euclidean space or the respiratory organs of snakes, titles of rival dissertations, I should then receive £80 a year and rooms in college and a free meal every evening and be allowed to impart my knowledge to others. There was a long pause. At last, he raised his head and said, "Well, of course I hope you'll succeed." "Thanks very much." Another silence ensued, during which I calculated Ansel's chest measurement. We were about the same at 14, and then tried to console myself by calculating his brain capacity. It was a close evening, and rain was impending. We were about halfway now, where the road goes up the river ravine in a ledge that has been cut in the rock. Far below us, almost shrouded in trees, ran the river. An open wooden fence guarded us from the precipice. Just where the ravine is steepest, horseflies set Josiah dancing.
"Steady! Steady there, steady!" said Ansel. "Steady! Steady! Steady! Bang!"
Josiah had backed the cart against the wooden railing. He drew forward, calculated his distance, and backed again. Bang! And crack! For the fence was giving. He drew forward again.
"Jump out, Master Edward," cried Ansel. "I daren't loose the reins, for you daren't hold them."
Indeed, I was perfectly numb and incapable with terror. I could not move. I could only wonder whether we should all strike the river at the same time, and whether it would be at the same place. The box, Ansel, me, Josiah, and the box was behind me, so I should fall on it, bound with iron corners. Bang! And a long crack this time, for the fence was reeling backwards. Something slipped from the cart into the abyss, and I concluded it was me, then that it was Ansel who was gone. But no, he had got out before the concussion and had taken advantage of the recoil to haul Josiah forward and just save us from going over the edge. Josiah had kicked him on the shin, and he had torn the armholes out of his new suit, but we were safe. It then struck me that what had gone was the box. A great deal was crowded in that half-second, for I was just in time to see the conclusion of its fall. About halfway down, it hit a projecting rock, opened like a water lily, and rained its sweetness upon the deep. Then I heard the voice of Ansel.
Them boats saved us. They went at the very moment. I felt them tugging us over the edge. Ansel, I said. Oh, I'm all right, Master Edward.
I felt ashamed, for I had not been going to ask after his health. After a decent interval, I said, shall we be able to get the books and papers back? Oh, I dare say we shall one or two. But the river's swift and few shallows, and the rain's come in. We may try tomorrow. You know, it means that I've failed if I lose those books.
Aye, said Ansel.
Well, there's other things but books.
It means, well, it's as if you had to lose your leg.
I never have lost my leg, and I don't want to, said Ansel, not to be moved from questions of fact. I felt only brilliant conversation would save me from insanity, and knew that Ansel would not find me out if I borrowed the brilliant remarks of others. I sparkled a few minutes to myself, and then had to stop. Suicide seemed the only course, when Ansel began to talk. He began right away from the all-pervading subject, and kept away from it too. He began by a description of the new shooting, how it ran up the Carlham Woods right into the heart of the hills, and took in a bit of the great East Moor. Then I heard of the new barn, and the cowhouse, and the plan for supplying the house from the river direct, the probable profits of his aunt, and the probability of his inheriting them. And finally, he burst into a description of the great landslip in the Upper Burn, which had turned an arid waste of rocks and pebbles into a deep bathing pool. It did not soothe me, but I was conscious of the artistic effect, and that was something. If I met with one sign of true sympathy, I think I should break down. But fortunately, I do not. The utmost anyone will venture is that they are sorry for my disappointment, but now I shall be able to have a real holiday. To do them justice, they have been very kind.
I suppose you've got it all in your head, all right, said my cousin. When you know a thing, you know a thing.
But when he realised I had not, he at once countermanded the projected shooting party for the morrow and ordered a grand search for the debris. As Ansel predicted, we got one or two, even more. He himself dived into the pool below the road and fished up the cover of an Aristotle and half a volume of discarded notes. We sent word downstream, and the miller sent up two or three books that had come down in the wheel. But of the unfinished dissertation and the essential notes, there was not a sign. The household was hopeful, seeing that the salvage filled a fair-sized basket, and a person so clever as Mr. Edward would be sure to be able to find something in it to write about. But I knew that my career was closed. If I met with one sign of sympathy, I should break down. But Ansel has appropriated me, and I have no time to think of the future. I cannot fend him off. I have a bruise on my shoulder from shooting, and a cut on the foot from bathing, and the pony has rubbed my knee raw against a wall, and we talk, goodness knows what of. I cannot remember afterwards, but I know that an allusion to the box of books is a recognised witticism. Little and Scott's Greek lexicon remains open on the ledge where the box split. In dry weather, an invisible person rapidly turns over the leaves, hurrying from one word to another. But in the damp, his ardour flags. There's something rather poetical in the idea of this unembodied searcher after knowledge, and I would write a Greek epigram on him, but I'm forgetting the words. Whenever we pass the place, Ansel looks over and says, "Them books," and laughs. And I laugh too, as heartily as he, for I have not yet realised what has happened.
Peter Kenny was reading Ansel by E.M. Forster. The producer was Harriet Lang.